And welcome to the Sounding Off with Kim Munson podcast. Be sure and check out our website. That is Kim Munson, MONSON.com. Sign up for our weekly newsletter. That way you'll get all the first look at all of our upcoming guests, our most recent podcast, and our most recent op-eds. I am pleased to have on the line with me Benjamin Huseman. He is the mayor of Commerce City right here in Commerce City, Colorado. And there's a lot that has been happening up in Commerce City and also in Adams County. Benjamin, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, ma'am. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, you are the mayor of Commerce City, Colorado. When were you elected?
I was elected last year, November 2019, and sworn in December.
Okay. Why did you decide to run for mayor?
I retired from the Air Force about 7.5 years ago, and as we were getting ready to retire from the Air Force, we chose to settle in Commerce City. The Air Force would have sent us anywhere in the world that we wanted to, come pack up all our goods and pick a place to live, and we chose Commerce City. And it's a community that I love. It's a community that I see great potential for, and it's just a community that we felt was going to be great for raising our daughter in. And I realized that if I wanted to raise my daughter in a good community, the best thing I could do would be to get involved. So back in 2016, I was appointed to the Commerce City's first Citizens Public Safety Advisory Board, and I looked at that as a great opportunity to get involved and help shape the future of how policing is done in Commerce City and help them to implement community policing in the 21st century, which I think is a great program and provides great opportunities for really helping police officers really engage in the community and develop those positive relationships that are critical to keeping public safety prominent. So shortly after that, in 2017, I decided to run for city council and got elected as a councilman at large, and spent 2 years trying to push through and make a difference in the community. And then last year, I was actually the last person to jump into the race for mayor, and I was looking at the list of candidates that were there and really felt that the best way to make change in Commerce City would be to take the bull by the horns and then for mayor myself. So I jumped into the race, ran a very lean campaign. Everything that was basically done, social media, all the posts and stuff was all coming out of me directly. Replies to constituents was all me, as opposed to having a staffer, a spouse, or somebody else doing that for them. And I also raised the least amount of money and spent the least amount of money in order to get elected. And it was truly a grassroots effort that I put forth out there because I wanted the people in Commerce City to have a voice in where their politics were going.
And it looks like the hard work really paid off, and you were elected. How does that work? How many people were in the race? Did you get a majority, plurality? How does that work up in Commerce City?
Sure. There were five people in the race, and in Commerce City, we don't require that one person get more than 50%. So the individual that has the most amount of votes out of those five people is the one that is elected. My vote count, I think, was about 3,000, just over 3,000. And the second place individual with about 2,100 votes, and third place about 1,800 votes. So that's different from a lot of communities where you have a runoff election. In Commerce City, we don't push that runoff election.
As I've seen you kind of on the horizon there on different things, and you really seem to be taking the role the way I think the founders thought that, and that is servant leadership, representing the people. I think a lot of people that are elected to city councils and to mayors start to think that they work for an entity, which is the city, instead of the people. But it looks to me like you are representing the people, Ben Huseman.
You know, that is my goal, is to represent people. And it is my goal to always have that in the forefront of every decision that I make. And, you know, what I see a lot in at the municipal level, the county level, the state level, and the national level, is people are frustrated with their government. They feel like government makes whatever decision they want to without actually taking their best interest in the heart. And, you know, sometimes these decisions are made in vacuums. Sometimes these decisions are basically presented as this is what's best, but there's no rationale, there's no explanation, there's no feedback given to the community members to have them understand. And so one of the things that I have tried to do, sometime I'm not as successful as I wish it was, is really be there to be able to engage with the residents and to be able to address their concerns. And it's kind of been a struggle because I see a lot of the struggles that the residents have. I see a lot of the gripes and the concerns and the feeling like nothing is getting better that they have. And I take that forward and I'm trying to make a difference on that. And in a lot of cases, I don't have support. In some cases, I get unanimous support. But what I really find is that there's just a resistance to change. You know, I think one of the greatest things, you know, we had a string of public safety incidents here in Commerce City, to include Labor Day weekend. We had two shootings with six people wounded. And a resident stepped up and said, look, Denver's got this ShotSpotter system. Why don't you guys have it? And I said, you know, that's a great idea. Let's look at that. So the next council meeting, I said, hey, can you please go out and research the ShotSpotter system? Figure out what the cost is to it. Figure out what the feasibility is to it. And figure out what kind of grant programs there are to help us to be able to reduce those costs so that we can make an informed decision. And really feeling like, look, this is a concern that the citizens have put forth. This is something they want to see in their community to hopefully help make their community safer. Seeing the success that it's had in other communities with reduction in gun violence, reduction in injuries, and things like that. And the response that came back was, yeah, it's about $3 million. We don't have the funding. We don't know about getting grants, so we're just going to close the section of it. And it's appalling to me that, number one, you were asked to go and figure out this information for us so that the city council can make a budget decision on whether or not this is something the city council wants to invest in order to make the community safer for the residents. And you have people who just say, no, that's okay. We don't want to do that. And it's frustrating to me to not be able to have those dialogues and be able to have those action items to where we can truly make those informed decisions on what is best for the community.
And Benjamin, I missed it. What is this program exactly that you were wanting to research?
It's called a ShotSpotter system. Basically, Denver has implemented one as well. You put sound sensors up throughout your community, a network of them. And if you have a gunshot go out within the city, then it is capable of triangulating the location of that gunshot in order to speed up response of first responders to get there in order to try to, you know, figure out who it is that committed the crime or if there's any further incident that needs to be responded to. Like I said, Denver has implemented, numerous communities across America have implemented it. When you look at the statistics, I mean, people are seeing 30% to 50% reduction in gun violence. And so I really felt that this was something that in a community where we are struggling to come to grips with recent shootings, that this is something maybe an investment like this could truly help us to make our streets safer again.
Okay. And to implement the program, it would be $3 million, or the study was $3 million?
The cost to implement the program was estimated around $3 million. Depends on how robust of a program or a system you want, how, you know. And I think whenever Denver did theirs, they started small and it slowly expanded year over year in order to get theirs where they want. But there's also, you know, there's grants out there and there's funding out there, and it's just a matter of, you know, putting your effort into determining how can we do this, but at the same time, allowing the elected people to make the decision on whether or not this is a budget item that you want to spend money on. And this is just one example of just things that you struggle to wrap your head around. Why is it that whenever we are trying to make things better, there seems to be a constant pushback to say, no, that's not what we want to do. And again, as you said very eloquently, there are people who serve on city councils who forget they were elected by the people to represent the people, not the government. And I think that that's a struggle that a lot of us are facing with governments in our communities.
That makes me think about this whole bureaucratic administrative state that we have going on. What I saw when I was on city council in Lone Tree for 4 years, and you probably go to some of the Colorado Municipal League meetings, that many of the people that are elected to city council rely on lobbyists. They rely on paid staff to make their decisions, and certainly understand you're looking for help from people that are doing that full time. However, my part-time city council job was actually, I think, at least 40 hours a week, plus all the other stuff I did with family and my other job. It is a real commitment to do that. But there's a kind of a reliance that it's gospel if it's coming from a lobbyist or if it's coming from a bureaucrat or city staff. And when I had you on the show just recently, you mentioned you were in a study session asking hard questions, and you were getting pushback on that. I did the same thing. I took my job very seriously, that I was representing the people, and we need to get these answers. And many times the presentations can be nuanced to try to get to something that's already been decided by staff and sometimes by some of the other politicians. What's your comments on that?
I definitely have to agree with what you're saying. Ever since I've been involved on the city council, I've always felt as if the city staff has driven the council. And one of my goals has always been to reverse that, to make it so that the council is driving the city staff with the vision mm-hmm. that they want to put forth. You're right, you sit in a study session or you sit in a council meeting or a public hearing, and you're given a slide presentation, and that slide presentation contains information that you're supposed to make an informed decision on. And what I'm finding is sometimes those presentations don't include all of the facts. They don't include all of the relevant information that we truly need in order to make an informed decision. And that's unfortunate. And we've had a couple instances lately that have really caused me to question the validity of information that is put in front of me in order to make those decisions. And then whenever you go and you start doing your own research and you start looking at things, then you say, well, this doesn't add up. Why are you telling me this when something else is taking place, or there's data that contradicts what it is that you're telling me? And it makes it very difficult to sit there and make the best decision in the needs of the residents when you don't feel like you're getting the whole picture.
What you've just described is really important for electeds throughout the country to start to understand this. Many of the staff that work in city government or county government have gone to public administration schools at many of the universities, which I have finally figured out is in some ways pushing an agenda that I've seen that would like to move people into not using their cars, living in apartments instead of the private property, owning their own home. Those decisions, however you drive, wherever you live, wherever you work, should be a free decision. It should not be coerced by quote-unquote city planners, city staff that think that they know best how people should live their lives instead of everyday people making those decisions for themselves. Your thoughts, Benjamin?
It's unfortunate in America we like to consider ourselves as free. One of the things that I'm always saying to people is that you're free to choose that which has been pre-approved for you. We don't truly have the freedom to go off and decide what it is we want to buy unless it's already been approved by somebody that we can purchase it. You look at your cable bill. You don't have the ability to choose, I want this channel, that channel, this channel. It's a prepaid package that has basically been approved for you to get. Vehicles, you have to buy one that has been pre-approved through the government. And this lack of freedom that we have starts at the national level and comes all the way down to the local level, where your decision on things that you can do is only if somebody has already said it's okay for you to make that choice. And you're right, that definitely plays into whether, hey, planning says that you can have this type of location there, you can have, this type of building or this type of residence. And, oh, by the way, if you're going to build this type of residence, then you have to meet these requirements and everything. There's a need for codes. There's a need for building codes that are going to make sure that the residents are safe, especially whenever we start talking about multifamily and things like that. But there's still this control factor that has come and been pushed down on much of it through the guise of safety, of, hey, we have to protect you from yourself. And we see that today, even with the COVID pandemic that we have going on, we have to protect you from yourself. It's our job to do that. And that's not true. I mean, the role of government is to allow us to make those decisions, to have the freedom to make those decisions. But ever since the founding documents were signed, that role has changed to where government thinks they have to protect us from ourselves. And that's just unfortunate.
Well, it's interesting that you would bring up building codes, because I drilled down as presentations were being made on whether or not Lone Tree would require that all buildings, residential and non-residential, but homes and apartments, would have to have sprinkler systems in them in the case of fire. That increases the cost significantly for home ownership. And as I learned about it, there is a meeting every few years by like all the building code people in government. And actually what you can will see is that there will be different industries that are coming in lobbying for new regulations to use their product. And of course, if you force somebody to have to use that product, then that increases that company's sales. And the case was in sprinkling systems. And fortunately, we did not change the rules to those new building code guidelines. They update them every few years, which is just more and more regulations. We've gotten past on building codes, I think, from something just to keep people safe to we are moving towards rules and regulations that are pushing forward possible certain agendas. And that was a real eye-opener for me when I realized that it was the sprinkler building industry that was out there lobbying for regulations that their product would be have to be in all these new bills. And that was a real eye-opener for me, Benjamin Huseman.
You know, we recently had, I think it was last year, we had a similar vote on whether or not to include the sprinklers in single-family homes as well. And, you know, what people who advocate and say, hey, it's all about safety, they fail to realize the amount of maintenance that goes into a sprinkler system. They fail to realize the testing, the inspections that have to be done. And they also fail to realize the failure rate. You know, there are times whenever sprinklers, for no reason other than just a failure of the device itself, will go off. And now you've got flood damage. Now you've got all these other issues that have to go. So you end up with $20,000 in flood damage. Great, your homeowner's insurance covers it. We get enough of that going on, what happens? Everybody's homeowner's insurance goes up, and it affects everybody else. It's very similar to when we have a major hailstorm. You can have a major hailstorm come in, affect the insurance industry. Your house wasn't affected, but your rate goes up. And you say, why did my rate go up? Well, because across the state of Colorado, we had a bunch of hailstorms that we had to pay out on, so everybody goes up. And so if you take that and you apply it to the failures that you have in sprinkler systems and things like that, what is that going to do to the ability of people who are on a fixed income to be able to afford the house that they're living in? What is that going to do to people who are struggling with this pandemic right now to get the hours that have been cut from their work or to get out there and get a new job? Now you're going to say, oh, by the way, you have to have the sprinkler system. Oh, by the way, somebody has to come in and inspect it for you. Oh, by the way, you're going to have an actual preventer that's got to be inspected as well. And all these other things that go along with it. And you're absolutely right. Who benefits from this? Do the residents truly benefit from it, or does the industry? Does the industry that is producing the material, that is out there doing the service, that is out there having to do the inspections? And so it's very troubling whenever you break things down and you actually look at where some of those decisions are being pushed and some of the key players that are actually trying to push these regulations on the cities. And it's troubling to see that.
Okay, you are asking the right questions as an elected representative. Let's move over. There was a recent article in the Denver Post that said the seven other city council members voted to censor you for, I think, a month. What does that mean exactly, Benjamin Huseman?
Seven council members did vote to censure me. They did not agree with the questions that I asked on our October 12th study session regarding retail and Commerce City. They didn't agree with the directness that I asked those questions, the demeanor that I had. so the motion was the censure. There was some confusion as the vote was going on, as far as is it for a month, is it for a period of two meetings, or how that goes. And I had reached out to the city manager or city attorney at the time and said, hey, if this vote passes, then do I leave the meeting? Am I done? Am I shut down? And the answer is no, that it really shouldn't have a time limit on like that. They can just vote to censure you. So the month period in there, there's some confusion over what that actually means. But, you know, it's unfortunate because our council members didn't follow our council policy. And our council policy says that if you have an issue with somebody, then deal with it directly. Confront the issue head on. If you're not comfortable doing that, then solicit the help of the city attorney or the city manager to help deal with that issue. And that policy was completely ignored. And instead, they just decided to come out with the censure motion. And, you know, again, there was obvious that there was coordination behind the scenes before the meeting took place, before that motion was made, which I think CERSA calls that having a rolling quorum, which, again, we're cautioned about not doing that as elected officials. Yet all these things took place, but that doesn't take away from the fact that the council felt that my behavior was inappropriate. And, you know, sometimes that's tough to hear whenever people don't agree with what you're doing. I struggle very much with the data that was given to me in that presentation. I struggle very much with the rationale behind some of the statements that were made. And I was very pointed in my questions, and I was very pointed in saying, why is it that your report says this, but this isn't true? So how can I trust the validity of your report? And, you know, I've had some council members say, you know, it was uncomfortable. It was uncomfortable watching. And I apologize that it was uncomfortable for people to watch. But at the end of the day, my goal is to get the facts out there. And my goal is to try to figure out whether or not this information that is here, number one, is factual. And number two, what can we do with it? And how can we change how it is that we are going about conducting business in order to reverse what is in the report? And like I said, it's an unfortunate situation. It's caused me to step back and reevaluate a lot of things about myself and a lot of things about the position that I'm in. It's a struggle.
Well, thank goodness when the founding fathers were putting together the U.S. Constitution that they didn't figure out that they had to have a right off the bat unanimous decision. There was a lot of dialogue that probably was pretty uncomfortable for people from time to time, but with the goal of getting to something, a document that would really protect the individual, the individual's rights, keep government within its proper role. It is astounding to me that from what I can understand, you were censured because you asked some hard questions which made some rubber stamp people, that's my commentary, uncomfortable, and therefore they decided to do this, which got a headline. I would encourage you to have courage, Benjamin Huseman, because you served in the military. We look at the people that have come before us. We stand on the shoulders of giants, and it's taken courage to protect these freedoms for the individual, and it's exciting when people like you step forward to do that. I want to talk about one other thing. It looks like Tri-County Health is going to, well, they are. They're actually using higher COVID infection rates to start to close down schools and businesses. And it's important to understand that the more people that we test, we are going to have higher infection rates. But the questions are you sick? And what kind of test was it? Was it an antibody? Was it a viral test? And I'm very concerned that people are not making that distinction. And before these new shutdowns have been recommended, there were some quote-unquote secret meetings by PBIs up in the North Metro area, Adams County commissioners, some of the mayors up there. You were in that meeting, and you thought the public had a right to know what was going on. Tell us about that.
You know, all the way back in April, it was, whenever this COVID kicked off, we started with, in other words, there's always been Adam ad hoc meetings, Adams County governance meetings, which brings in elected people from all across the county to work together, figure out what's going on in the different communities. And then there's the executive level meeting of the same nature that brings in the city manager, the mayors, and the commissioners, and the county manager. And so whenever COVID kicked off, these meetings started up all the way back in April of, hey, we're going to meet and we're going to talk about what's going on with COVID in Adams County. And none of these meetings were ever publicized to the community outside of the elected officials that got the invitations. And so those meetings were progressing, and we were getting updates of what's going on. We were having elected officials from BC, you know, sit on the meeting, tell us what they're hearing, things like that. And again, none of these meetings ever taking place or ever being posted. No agendas being posted, no information going out. Then shortly thereafter, Adams County had their consulting firm, which is called Strategy with Lux. And they were having meetings where they were talking about these are the steps that we're going to have to take in order to reopen buildings, in order to reopen the county, reopen cities, businesses, things like that. And again, none of these meetings were being advertised to anybody. And so I actually wasn't even aware that these meetings were taking place with the strategy from us. Adams County had actually sent the invitation for all these meetings to my campaign email address, which is an email address that I don't monitor because I'm not campaigning. And so this information wasn't aware to me. And one day in May, our city manager at the time, he called me and he said, hey, are you going to be on the meeting today? And I said, I don't know what meeting we're talking about. And so that's whenever we realized that they had actually been sending the invitations to my campaign email address instead of my official email address, which I'd had for 2.5 years by this point in time, which the county knew. So I jumped on the meeting that we had there, Strategy as well. And I think almost every commissioner was there. There may have been one that wasn't there, but almost every commissioner was there. And the conversation started up about, hey, you know, these are the things we want to see before we start opening things back up. And I voiced an objection at the time, and I said, wait a minute. What happened to 2 weeks to flatten the curve? You know, everything was all about, we're just going to do this temporarily just to make sure we don't overload the hospital, and got a lot of pushback on that one. And so my comment back, I said, look, I said, it's real easy to sit here and not recommend that we open stuff back up when you're still making your six-figure salary, when your pay hasn't right. been affected. But whenever the residents are out there, and they're the ones that are struggling with it, and they're the ones that can't go to work, they're the ones that can't earn a living, they're concerned about losing their entire life savings, concerned about losing their business that they've worked their entire life to get to, we can't be making these decisions when our pay is not affected. And instantly drew condemnation. Some people thought that was a personal attack, and we can't go there. We got to leave politics out of this and everything. And I was blown away that these decisions and these talking points of what we want to do were being put into these meetings without the public knowing that this is what's being said. So we had one of the monthly meetings. They were weekly meetings, then they went to biweekly, then they went to monthly. We had one, and I jumped on and I said, you know what? I want the people in my community to know what is going on. I want them to have the firsthand knowledge, see the slide presentations that I have available to me, see the information, hear the discussion, hear the facts of what we're being told whenever these decisions are being made, so that they're aware of what's going into it. And so I started, I would sit there on Zoom, and on my computer on one screen, I would have the Zoom meeting. On my other computer, I would have Facebook Live going. And I basically use a software called OBS, which is an open source software for broadcasting and creating videos. And I started live streaming those Zoom meetings so that the public could see. And then back in the earlier part of this month, we got an email that, hey, cases in Adams County are on the rise. We're going to have an emergency meeting to talk about it. And I said, okay, well, you know, if cases are on the rise and this is going to impact life again, we need to have this information out to the public as quick as possible. And so live streamed that one again, and then as well as another one last week. And I really just feel like this information has not been shared with the public the way that it should. And I know that another reporter reached out to the county and said, hey, you know, what's going on with these meetings? And the representative from the county said, well, there's never more than three commissioners on those calls, so it doesn't violate open meeting law. And that's just not true. I mean, there's been 3, 4, 5 commissioners on the call. They normally take roll before these calls take place, in order during the initial part of the calls when they take place. So you're taking roll. You've got more than 3 members of a single government body on there, and you're discussing what's going to happen in the county and all of the cities that fall under the county's jurisdiction and the jurisdiction of Tri-County Health. And yet none of this information is being shared with the public. And I said, that's a foul. So I was really shocked whenever that was one of the justifications that our council member brought up of why I needed to be censored. And the comment was made that I'm bringing a negative light onto Commerce City by sharing these meetings that were never intended to be distributed. And it blew me away that, number one, they weren't intended to be distributed. Number two, people were upset that they were distributed. And number three, that people would think that it brings a negative light on our city that somebody is actually sharing this information with the public. Those 3 things are scary to me.
That's really scary. Benjamin Huseman, thank you for streaming those meetings as well. With you being censured, can you attend meetings? Do you still run the meetings? How does that work?
I am still able to attend my meetings and run my meetings. None of that changes. And again, that's one of the first questions is just what was getting ready to happen. And I had the city attorney goes, hey, do I leave the meeting now? And I was told, no, that's not the case. So, no, I can still do that. This week's been tough. We had a horrible incident take place last week, and dealing with the emotional side of that, followed by what happened Monday night, it's been tough. And I kind of stepped back and said, hey, I need a little bit of time for myself to kind of reevaluate where I am and what I'm doing and just kind of come to grips with some things. So I don't know if I will attend the study session on Monday night. It's been a struggle this week.
Can the public attend that study session?
So normally study sessions, yes, are public is able to attend. We don't take public comment in study sessions, but whenever we were doing them in person, up until the whole COVID thing, we had seats that the public could come and sit in and could participate and watch and see the data that is coming up. With the COVID and us going to 100% virtual meetings, everything is broadcast on Channel 8 or on our city's website. And so the public can watch the study sessions directly on there. The video of my question and answer period with the staff and the consultant is on the city's website. And anybody is welcome to go watch that and see the questions that I asked and why it is that I was censured. So that information is there. We had a vote recently where we were amending our emergency order that allowed us to conduct meetings virtually. And there was a part in there that said that we would no longer record and post these study sessions on our city, on our website. And it came time for a vote. We had a motion and a second to approve the ordinance and got to the discussion period. And I said, look, I'm not going to support this. I said, I disagree with us no longer recording and posting study sessions on the website. And it's been my goal even before COVID that we get to the point where we're broadcasting our study sessions, because the study sessions are where a lot of the information is given to us that we need to make our decisions on. And I really feel like the public has a right to have easy access to that information. The same way you can watch a council meeting online, you can watch a council meeting on Channel 8, you should be able to watch these study sessions to see how your elected person feels about an issue, to see the comments that they make. And that's not the most popular decision to have out there. So I will continue to push that we have our study sessions public. Even after we get back to having normal meetings, I will push that we are in a situation where we can broadcast those study sessions so that everybody has an opportunity to view those and see what's being said and the information that's being given to us. And that way, when we make a decision, they can say, well, yeah, whenever they made that decision, it was because the information they were given that said this and that.
Oh, I think that is super important. Now, if people want to go back to the city website to see your comments that caused the censure of you, what was the date? How can they find that on the website?
That was October 12th. So there should be there's going to be two meetings on October 12th. I actually called for a special city council meeting the week prior and requested it to be on Monday. I come out of her had seen this meeting that Adams County was calling because of the COVID case numbers and the fact that Adams County may have to revert back to stage three according to the COVID bio created by the governor. And I said, you know, this is going to kill our businesses. And so I called for a special meeting for October 12th in order to allow us to vote on expending the rest of our CARES Act funding and get that money on the street in order to protect our businesses and help them to survive this situation that we have going on. And so I called that meeting. So the very first part of it is we have about 30 minutes where we discuss the remaining CARES Act funding as well as the recommendations of where we can best apply that money to get it out there for our businesses. And then following that, we went into the study session. And the first part of the study session was a discussion on drainage in Commerce City and current practices and what we need to be doing in order to get more compliant with water regulations and things like that. And then the second part of the meeting was the presentation on retail in Commerce City.
Okay. Benjamin Huseman, we really need more elected representatives like you on the city government. You are taking your job seriously, and it takes courage to do what you're doing. And we are lucky that you have stepped forward to do this. What's your final thought that you would like to leave with our listeners today?
I really hope that people have an ability to be involved in their government. And whether that is running for office yourself or being involved in attending meetings, watching meetings, and paying attention to what is on agendas and what information your council is going to be voting on, I think that's just critically important. We truly need people to take a more active role. And we need people, whenever they're given information, to not just accept the information they're given as gospel and as truth, but actually use some analytical thinking to determine whether or not the information they're being given actually measures up to what is being experienced in the real world. And I think when more people step in and get involved like that, then I think it's only going to make our country better.
Oh, most definitely. Benjamin Huseman, Mayor of Commerce City, thank you so much for joining me on this Sounding Off with Kim Munson podcast. Keep up the good work.
Well, thanks, ma'am, and I appreciate the time and you having me on the show, and wish you continued success in getting the voice out there for good Americans who are fighting in order to make this a better place for all of us.
Definitely. Our job is to make sure that we pass on to the next generation, preserve what we got, and then pass on something better. So, Benjamin Huseman, thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am. Have a great day.
Okay, and this is Kim Munson signing off. God bless you, and God bless America.